Hello and welcome to The Late Debate with me, Audrey Carvel. On the programme tonight, locking women up.
I was living on the streets before I went into prison. And so it was a real fault in my head. So I was committing these crimes to get back into prison because it was giving me somewhere to stay overnight. You have to get stoned in prison to actually feel normal with anybody else.
Is prison the right place for women who offend? It's our debate tonight after the news from Eileen Whelan.
Good evening. The Garda Commissioner says he accepts the findings of the Smithwick Tribunal report, but he does not accept the claim that Gardaí placed loyalty to the force over honesty. The report found Gardaí colluded with the IRA in the murders of RUC officers Harry Breen and Robert Buchanan, who were shot dead in 1989. Commissioner Martin Callanan apologised unreservedly for any wrongdoing by members of the force. Weak governance in the financial sector remains too frequent, according to incoming financial regulator Cyril Roux. Addressing members of IBEX Financial Services Ireland tonight, he said the new instances of poor underwriting and provision, as well as ineffective auditing processes, continue to come to the attention of the authority. The new deputy governor of the central bank said each incident hindered attempts by the industry to rebuild public trust and had a knock-on effect on the country's reputation. A woman in her 40s has been arrested in connection with the investigation into the murder of a man in Limerick City last month. Paddy Redmond was stabbed at an apartment on Dock Road in Limerick on the 10th of November. Gardaí said the woman was detained this afternoon and has been questioned at Henry Street Garda Station. A man has died following a road crash in County Armagh. The 66-year-old man was the driver of a car that was involved in a three-vehicle collision on the Madden Road in Tandragee. The road will remain closed overnight and local diversions are in place. The Irish Language Commissioner, Sean O'Quirin, has resigned, criticising the lack of progress in ensuring that Irish speakers can deal with the state through Irish. The Minister of State with responsibility for the Gaeltacht, Dinny McGinley, said Sean O'Quirin was held in high regard and he regretted his decision to resign. There was no winner of tonight's lotto jackpot worth over €2.3 million. The numbers drawn were 13, 16, 31, 43, 44 and 45. The bonus number was 23. The weather forecast: showers in the west and north becoming confined to coastal districts. Frost in many places tonight with a risk of ice. Lowest temperatures -1 to +3 degrees. There's a warning of west to southwest winds or strong gales tonight on all Irish coastal waters and the Irish Sea, with storm force winds on coasts from Errishead to Rossonpoint to Belfast Lough. And that's all for now. News again at 11. But back now to The Late Debate.
Eileen, thank you very much indeed. You're very welcome back to the programme. The majority are just looking for help, any help, to try and get off these bloody drugs, to get my children back, get a place of my own, get a job, turn my life around and get away from the abuse that I have suffered from him. The words today of Judge Michael Riley, the Inspector of Prisons, in his latest report on the women's prison in Dublin, the Dorcas Centre. Tonight we're debating whether or not prison is the best place for women who offend. Joining me on the programme are Labour Senator Ivana Bacik, who was rapporteur on this issue for an Oireachtas Justice Subcommittee earlier this year. Also here is Liam Herrick, Executive Director of the Irish Penal Reform Trust, which hosted a conference on the issue this morning. Dervil MacDonald is Associate Editor and Legal Affairs Editor with the Irish Independent, and Áine Morris, who worked as a probation officer in Dorcas for 10 years. You're all very welcome indeed. Judge Riley's report found that Dorcas had lost its way. He characterised it as a disconnect between management and staff. He said discipline issues were not being dealt with properly and that there was massive overcrowding, something he described as the single biggest problem associated with the centre. He suggested that prison was not the right place for many of the women, but that the courts had nowhere else to send them. Well, we'll hear from a woman who spent time in Dorcas in a few minutes, but I just want to get the panel's response to Judge Riley's comments and his report, his overall report on Dorcas. And Áine Morris, I'll start with you, because you worked in Dorcas for 10 years. You left there last year. Does his comments reflect the reality of working in Dorcas?
Well, first of all, what I'd say is I'd preface my comments by saying I'm speaking on behalf of the Probation Officers Branch of Impact and not on behalf of the Probation Service. And indeed, I did work in the Dorcas Centre. And what I would say is that on reading the report, what I was struck by was the issue around overcrowding and what that means for, I suppose, the professionals working in the Dorcas Centre and for the women themselves. When the Dorcas Centre was established in 1999, 1999, it really was a new departure. It was heralded internationally as being a new way of working with women in custody. And overcrowding has a very direct impact on very practical issues, such as women having to share bedrooms. And for many of the women that come to the Doak Centre, they come because of difficult, traumatic lives. Mm. And the idea should be that while they are in the Doak Centre, they can access, and there are services available, they can access psychology, work with the probation services, and, you know, have time then, a safe place in their rooms at night to go through that information and a safe place to be.
And just to illustrate the extent of the overcrowding, yeah. I mean, I think that the capacity is 105, mm-hmm. but in June the population was 141.
Mm-hmm. Which is a huge level of overcrowding. I mean, back in 2007, when I first began working there, 100 in the Doak Centre, bearing in mind the capacity at that stage would have been 85, was considered to be a difficult day for both the women and for both the staff working there. And I suppose what our members, you know, would be eager to see is that, you know, the Doak Centre can function in a way where the probation service and the psychology service and all the other agencies can work with the women in a facility where the women have access to their own bedrooms at night, where the you know, as the report points out, that tensions that are caused by overcrowding, you know, should be dealt with. Mm-hmm. And this is really is quite important. But I suppose the major thing that are the members of the Probation Officers Branch of Impact, you know, welcome, the major issue is the call for a debate. Yes. Because for too long, the debate about women in prison has been about, you know, doing the odd vox pop of women outside of the Doak Centre, and the general theme has been, well, isn't it a hotel in there? Mm-hmm. Well, it's not, and I can tell you it's not. There's great work done in there. The governor and her staff really, and the probation service there, really work hard to provide a good service for the women. But they do that with major constraints. And really what we need is we need a debate about how we approach women, how we approach the traumatic lives that they've had, how we need to talk about issues such as the concept of double deviance. These women are punished by, first of all, you know, by the criminal justice system, but then they're punished by society, mm-hmm. they're punished by families.
And we'll get into all of that later in the programme, but I just want to just stick with you, Áine, because you're the only mm-hmm. person on the panel who has actually worked in Doak. Mm-hmm. And when Judge Riley talks about this disconnect between management and staff, what does he mean, do you think? Did you experience that?
No, I suppose, as a probation officer, I would have been employed by the probation service, and that is a separate agency mm-hmm. to the Irish Prison Service. So I really couldn't speak on that issue with any authority. But I know he points to that. But what I would say is that I welcome the fact that, and my members of the Probation Office Branch of Impact would welcome the fact that the Governor O'Connor appears to have taken on board mm-hmm. Judge Riley's recommendations, and you know the fact that there is goodwill here. There is goodwill, I would think, in the management of the Doak Centre to bring about the changes that are necessary. But that needs resources.
Liam Herrick, anything in this report from Judge Riley that surprised you in any way?
No, I wouldn't think so. I think what is in Judge Riley's report would be very much echoing what we have in our position paper, which we published this morning. I think, as Áine said, it's wonderful to see the interest in a debate about this issue now, not just from people in the criminal justice system. We had Minister Kathleen Lynch launching our paper today. There's engagement from homeless services, mental health services and addiction. And I think there's a growing understanding that this is something that makes economic and social sense to try to look at solutions outside of the criminal justice system. And it also, you know, it cannot be solved by building more spaces. I think up until now, the debate has been very limited and shallow in that when we hear that women are deliberately offending to end up in detention, or where the judges are sending women into prison because they're fearful of their safety, there's been somewhat of a reaction that means prison's too good. But of course, really it indicates that the community that they're coming from is so appallingly bad that women are willing to lose their liberty to get away from the dangerous and chaotic lives that they have. And that is what the reality is of the increase in the number of women being sent to prison. We have a doubling in the number of women women committed per year to the Doka Centre in the last 10 years. That's not expressing anything to do with an increase in crime. The population isn't up. It's indicating that more and more women are being sent in for short sentences.
Liam, Dermot MacDonald, one of the things that did stagger me actually on reading Judge Riley's report was that in 1990 there were 155 committals to women committed to prison. 2005, that was 402 committals. Last year, 2,092. The crime rate amongst women in Ireland has surely not escalated. And I think that is the one thing that staggered me, even though I've seen these figures before, but actually to see 155 in 1990.
That struck me as well as being, you know, a massive point, that it's not just the overcrowding on any one day that Anya has spoken about so eloquently and that the judge describes as being such a serious problem, but it is also this massive increase in the numbers of committals. But then, of course, you delve into those figures and you see that of those 2,000 plus committals in 2012, 80% were fine defaulters. 83% were for less than 3 months. Yeah. Obviously the same proportion. But so we're talking about a population of women, large numbers of whom are being committed for very short periods.
One of the key things here is that, of course, you know, when you've got a massive increase like this in a country, in any country, you'd imagine that we would be having this debate and we'd be able to say, well, the reasons why the increase is so dramatic is because of X, Y and Z. But we don't collect the kind of data that they do in other jurisdictions. So we can't make definitive analysis, but we can tell some things. Most of these are fine defaulters. There is a number of women at the moment that are serving long sentences in relation to homicide or drug trafficking and sexual offences as well. They're not a statistically significant amount of the overall population, but that has increased slightly. But it wouldn't explain the pressure and overcrowding. The pressure and overcrowding is coming for women that are in for minor offences, but very often it's not their first minor offence. I met a woman in the Doka Centre during the week who had over 350 convictions. There are a lot of people that are in and out of the system all the time, and that clearly is an expression of how much it fails that
they're
coming in out so much.
I think though that high rates of recidivism or reoffending is due to the, you know, the complete lack of meaningful supports for women when they come out, the complete lack of joined up thinking, and then they get into a vicious circle. Like, I mean, if you read Judge Riley's report, and it's quite a brief report, and you know, those of us who are interested in or write about this issue, you're not surprised by it. But mostly these women are being criminalised because of addiction, because of homelessness, because of abuse that they've suffered, particularly sexual abuse in childhood and their adult life. Some of them are so relieved to get into prison to escape a partner or in an otherwise abusive, you know, situation. They come out, they don't have the proper support. So what do? They reoffend again. They're back in. And that is just the vicious circle.
Mental illness is the other big issue. I mean, that's again highlighted in the Penal Reform Trust paper, in Judge Riley's and in earlier research, looking at just the large numbers of women prisoners.
What I would say is that while there are, you know, there's a lack of resources, there are services there that can be built upon. There are quite simple and straightforward answers here. And I suppose if you take the probation service, they began operating a model of through care in 2007. So you meet the woman at the point of sentence, you work with her through her through the sentence and on her release from custody. And what, you know, what is important to note is that for many women, they may be subject to a statutory court order where the court requests that type of intervention from the probation service. But for other women, that order isn't there, but they choose to work with the probation service on release from prison. Women want this help, and there are services such as the DePaul Hostel, which is funded by the probation service. And I suppose our members in Impact will be calling for you know, more services like this, where, you know, it's very much based on meeting the women where they're at rather than where we want them to be.
Okay.
And it's about, but it's also about working on therapeutic relationships and a safe place for women. As you know, many women view the Doka Centre as a safe place, but we need safe places in the community.
Audrey, I think a couple of years ago, I think it was Harry Kennedy, maybe the former director of the Central Mental Hospital, said at one point, and he was just describing, I think, prisons in general as the psychiatric A&E units. And I think that is a huge problem for our prisons, male and female, is that the prevalence of people in there with serious mental health problems. And I think that is one of the reasons why we see people going, you know, straight back in. And women in prisons can be a bit of a taboo subject because people either see them as kind of high profile killers, or there's a distinct lack, and that's why I welcome this debate, because there's a distinct lack of sympathy about the plight of women because people do not understand. I work in the courts, and if you spend any amount of time in the district court and see the women that are coming before the courts that end up, you know, in jail, and you see the futility of it. I remember there was one case, a very landmark case, which actually led down to the striking of our laws that sent debtors to jail, and that was the case of Caroline McCann, who was, by her own admission, an alcoholic who'd spent many times in and out of hospital, who had to get in and testify in a case. And she was facing the threat of jail for non-payment of, I think it was a credit union fine. And it's the government obviously was defending a law that it ultimately couldn't stand over. But just to see the futility, firsthand, to see the futility of sending these women need therapeutic help in many cases. And of course, the state has to have a reason. Jail has to be there as a last resort, but it shouldn't be a first resort. And I think that raises the question, what are the tools in judges' hands? Are they bound by the limited range of options that they have when these women come before them?
Okay. I think the district court should be the focus. I mean, if you look at the figures and the large numbers of committals for very short sentences, and many of those women committed on sentences of less than 3 months will be out in a matter of days. Mm-hmm. There's no real time for any proper rehabilitation or therapeutic intervention. It's very hard for the services to intervene there. And it does again raise that question of futility of sentencing. But it is about district court sentencing practice. And I think, you know, that's an area that is generally overlooked in media reporting and in terms of popular knowledge. We tend to focus on the more significant offences in the higher courts. It's the district courts that are sending these large numbers in for these very short sentences.
Well, look, you've raised lots of points there, and we'll get into to some of them in more detail. But I want to play this tape now of this woman who has spent a number of occasions in the Dorcas Centre for shoplifting. Our reporter Richie Byrne went along and met her today. Her name's Mandy. It's not her real name. She was jailed on a number of occasions, and she told him her story.
I first went in, it was 1998. I was 18 when I first went into prison.
Which is quite young.
I was very young, yeah, at that time.
And what was it like going in to those doors?
It was very frightful. I was very afraid. Yeah. Because I didn't know anything about street life. I thought I was going to go into prison, get a beating.
She must have been terrified.
I was. Now, I'm going to be very honest with you. When I got to see, I was living on the streets before I went into prison. And so it was a roof over my head. So I was committing these crimes to get back into prison because it was giving me somewhere to stay overnight.
Keep you warm.
To keep me warm, keep a roof over. Because I slept out in the streets, and like I slept in Temple Bar. And there's one incident I'll never forget of a man coming out. It was in the middle of winter, and he came out and threw a bucket of water over me, freezing cold water. Now, I did not want to go back to that.
So while you're in prison, did you learn to defend yourself when you're in there?
Yeah.
What did you learn?
I had umpteen fist fights in there. Because you have to get stoned in prison to actually feel normal than with everybody else. Like, to feel normal, you have to just be stoned out of your head all the time. You're all crushed in the one area. I think there should be more places, more beds for people. Because I remember when I was in prison that there was people in beds and then there was about four people on the floor. God forbid if there was a fire. How would you have got out with four people on the floor and you're in a bed? How would you get over all them? Seriously.
So you feel like your life's not your own?
No. But when I was on the methadone programme, I was guaranteed my methadone inside. So I was grand. But then in 2004, I went in. I was pregnant and I had done a jump over. It was a cafe right beside my clinic, it was. I jumped over the counter. I used to work in a shop. So I opened the till. I just put in one coffee, cash, €10. And then the till opened and I just took the biggest notes and then jumped back over the counter. I was pregnant. I jumped back over the counter and ran by a police station. How stupid can you be? But I did. I ran right by a police station. And I ran up O'Connor Street and I got caught. I was up in court in October. I was due my baby in December. But I was locked up for 6 months of my pregnancy. I was locked up for waiting on remand, until I seen this certain judge. I can't remember his name. And the judge said, who could ever lock a girl up in that state? And so basically, I was very big, pregnant. I was strung out to bits. Like, I was really, really bad on drugs. So with a bump out that size and ready to drop, I found out in prison that I was HIV positive while I was pregnant. And then the judge said, listen, I'm going to dismiss all our cases, let her out of prison. So I got out then and I haven't looked back and haven't went back.
So how long were you in prison altogether?
To count all the months and all, I'd say about 2.5 years.
And as a system, what would you say that needs to be done to improve it?
I think there should be an awful lot more counselling. when you're going into prison, because you can't talk to nobody when you go into prison. You're just thrown into a cell and that's it. Like, I've often been sitting in my cell and I've heard people crying and crying and crying, like literally crying their eyes out, because at night, like, we'd all talk through the shutters, like, that's your conversation, like, you know, but there can be a lot of bullying through that as well, like, you're going to get it in the morning, then that girl's terrified overnight, can't sleep, the door's open at 8 o'clock in the morning, next of all, she gets a bang or something. But, like, there's girls I know in prison, they've come in at first, and the people that get to them, and they'd strip them down to see if they have drugs on them. Like, when they went to prison, they would strip them down. If they haven't got drugs on them and they knew they were coming, they'd say, hold on, you knew you were coming in. So, yeah, oh, you're obviously stuffed. So they'd keep her in the room. They'd keep you in the room until you get that parcel out. If you've swallowed it, whatever way you've done it, they'd make sure they wait for that parcel to come out. And then they're your best friends till the parcel's gone. Then they're not friends with you no more.
Was there violence in there?
Was there violence in prison? Yeah, there was violence, a lot of violence. A lot of threats being made against vulnerable girls and girls that couldn't defend themselves, basically. To be honest with you, you're a wannabe. You wannabe like the rest of them. Like, I was at that stage at one stage where I couldn't defend me. I could defend myself now.
Did anything ever happen to you?
Yeah, I was attacked, yeah. I was attacked a few times.
And what kind of things happened to you when you said you were attacked?
A few girls jumped me, but a certain girl actually stood on my leg 3 times and broke my leg. And I came back in a cast. My leg was broken 3 places. I seen a girl getting scalded in the face with tea, and the more sugar you put in tea, it's the more it scalds you. So she got it all over her face and she had to get skin graft and all. But I think the worst I've ever seen was that girl being scalded.
Do you find you learned more about crime when you're inside?
I was just going to say that. You do learn a lot more about crime in there than you learn on the outside.
Like, you get to know the system, how it works, how to play it, is that it?
Yeah. And then you're becoming friends with people. And then when you get out, you're out using with them people. And, like, when your time is up in prison, you have to have a fixed abode when you get out of prison. But why don't prison service get you somewhere? For us to get out of prison, we're going to say, I'm living at, say, Black Hall Place. I don't know where. Just say you gave that address. You're not living there, but you're going down, you're living on the streets. So why can't they make places for people that are coming out of prison to live somewhere, not live on the streets?
So in other words, you're saying it's not just good enough to let people out, that there needs to be follow-up service after.
There does, definitely. Definitely there does.
What would you say to somebody who's going into the prison system for the first time?
Don't mix, because people are only friends with you when they're looking for something in prison. And, like, it's not only that. Like, if you were to go for a job, like, you have a criminal record, you're not going to get a job. Like, it's very, very hard to get a passport with a criminal background.
So you're stuck in a loop, really?
You're stuck in a loop. Yeah.
And what's life like for you now, Mandy?
At the moment, life is great at the moment.
You look great.
I've seen sense. I read the book. I've been there, wore the T-shirt. I pity anyone that's in prison. I really do pity anyone that's in prison, because prison is an awful thing. Like, you can get very lonely in prison and you're just left there. There's an awful lot of people trying to commit suicide in prison as well, because you can't handle it. And, like, if you're caught doing that, you're sent to CMH, Dundrum Hospital. You have to go to bed with just a gown on, and till you're fit to go back to prison, they'll send you back.
That was Mandy. It's not her real name. She was talking there to our reporter, Richie Byrne. She spent about 2 years in total in the Dhocas Women's Prison in Dublin over the last number of years. Her 9-year-old son, he lives with her now. So life going okay for Mandy at the moment. I'm sure it's a familiar story to you all, Liam Herrick, but it certainly smashes the view that prison is a safe place for women.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there are problems from time to time. I think, you know, picking up on something Anya said earlier, when the Dhocas Centre was built in 1999, it was a really visionary development, given particularly what had preceded it and the conditions women were detained in St. Patrick's before that. And I think in many respects, the essence of the model is still a really strong one. You know, a lot of the positive things have been eroded over recent years because of the overcrowding. That has huge knock-on effects in access to services. The doubling up has definitely created a massive amount of tension. It goes against the whole idea of the prison in the first place. And staff cuts in recent years combined with overcrowding mean that access to school and education has been cut back. And that has had a contributing factor to things like pressure about drugs and intimidation and so on too. But those things can be solved, you know. if the numbers were brought down, I would have confidence that the prison service, probation service and the other services would get the prison right and back to what it had been before. And the inspector says it's moving back in the right direction. The real question, though, is, you know, what happens after prison and indeed what happens before prison? Mm-hmm. And if you take the fact that a third of the women coming into the prison are homeless on coming in, and there's a good chance that more of them would be homeless on release. If we're really serious about trying to break the cycle, if we're really serious about trying to encourage women to leave the prison and not actually want to stay because they have nowhere else to go, then the solution has to lie outside of the prison. What's happening at the moment is we're actually putting a huge amount of resources into these women while they're in prison, in particular, in terms of education, health, child protection, because their children are often going into care. So if you counted up the amount of state investment in these women while they're in prison, it would be astronomical. Several hundred thousand per person per year. And we know that they're reoffending and coming back in again. Now, you can deliver the services in prison, which is the wrong place, and the prison service itself will tell you they don't want to be managing these problems, or you could deliver those services in the community. I think, as Zonia said earlier, if you had safe places in the community to deliver these services, your results would be much better. And that's the problem. We've ended up with trying to solve problems in a prison environment that can't ever be solved in a prison environment. And our homeless crisis is in fact what is causing the crisis in the female prison population. It is a homelessness problem, predominantly, and not a prison problem.
So the community services then, if that is the model on you, how would that work?
Well, at the moment, I mean, it is working at one level, but it needs to be expanded. So what we have is we have a probation-funded hostel run by the DePaul the DePaul Trust. And basically that offers six bedrooms basically in a house whereby women are, you know, where the DePaul Trust and the probation service work really well together. And I actually carried out some research from women who were past residents and women who were current residents in 2012. And, you know, what that research indicated was that when the probation service and the DePaul Trust worked together to deliver, you know, a good joined up piece of work into these women, they actually increased the occupancy levels there from 46% in I think 2004 to 2010 it'd been 95%
in the DePaul hostel,
in the DePaul,
which is close to Mountjoy levels. Isn't it?
It is the north side of Dublin.
Now, are you talking about women who have come through the prison system?
Women who had come through the prison system, who the probation service had worked with through their sentence and continued to work with them on release. Sometimes that was voluntary, the women agreed to it on a voluntary basis. Sometimes it was because they were on a post-release supervision orders. But basically what happened was that you had two agencies working very well together, and this continues to happen. And, you know, what the women I spoke to, what they spoke about as being important for them is that there was a sense that the going to the DePaul hostel reduced their feeling of isolation. A lot of these women, their family had cut ties with them. So the DePaul hostel made a fuss of their arrival, made it an event, introduced them to the other women.
How long can they stay there?
They can stay there for 6 months.
Right.
Okay. And the DePaul hostel and the probation service will work with them after they move on.
For how long, though? Presumably not indefinitely.
Well, it would depend. It would depend case by case. Sometimes for the length of their court order, or the length of their they may be on temporary release from prison, or for as long as, you know, up to 2 years, for as long as those women need it for those.
And what's
2 years.
Reoffending rate like then?
Well, for the women that I spoke to, the women who had moved on, four women I spoke to, they had all managed to stay out of the criminal justice system, and really because they had felt that the key working system and their work with the probation service had empowered them, that it was based on partnership, that, you know, it really was about looking at their strengths, and that you know, it allowed them to rebuild relationships with families, and really those what I would describe as a therapeutic relationship, they are often in complete contrast to their own personal relationships, which can be marked by, you know, domestic violence, abuse, you know, and a lot of trauma.
So ideally, Anya, would you have the women who, you know, the majority of whom are in prison for non-payment of fines, would they go directly to the...
Well, for women who come into prison homeless, you know, they you know, they should be identified at the point of committal, and they should be, you know, throughout their sentence, and, you know, maybe identified for, you know, temporary release, and that they should have access to these kind of small housing units, where, like the DePaul Hostel, where they have the support of key workers, where they have, you know, rules and regulations, which the women themselves, you know, identified as a positive thing, mm-hmm. because they put structure and routine, access to education and training.
But this, they would avoid already, prison altogether and go straight to a centre like that. Is
well,
that
clear? They could either, and obviously it's up to a judge, they could be used as an alternative to custody, it could be used in conjunction with the sentence, or it could be used to release women earlier from mm-hmm. prison, you know.
It's one of the things that Judge O'Reilly is actually very, very measured in his report, mm. but there's a few areas where he's very, very strong. And one of the things is saying, you know, that the Doha Centre should be telling all the relevant agencies in advance when women are coming out who are potentially homeless. But he says no woman on release from prison should be homeless in this regard. An excuse that accommodation is not available is not acceptable. It was one of the points that he was much stronger on. But he goes on then just to look at the number of alternatives. And again, he brings the judiciary in and saying, look, that we need a diversity of options for women, particularly those who are sentenced for less than a year, and the kind of things that have been debated before but not really fully implemented, the problem solving courts, which would kind of identify yeah. women at risk, and he's saying that no one agency or set of agencies can do this, that it's going to require a huge effort. And he again, he goes to that notion of security. He said that some women in Doha had told him that they thought it was a safe home again, and he said that it was important that security should be measured in all diversionary programmes mm. as well as, you know, on release. And I kind of thought what he did say was that, look, this debate must be undertaken immediately, but it must be conducted in an unemotional manner. And I think that's one of the risks with this debate as well, you know, because there can be a sense of just kind of going, well, they're just, you know, they're just homeless, they're just offenders, mm-hmm. they're just that. And I think that some of his suggestions in that regard are really, really strong. But he's very, very strong on the issue of homelessness mm-hmm. and identifying it early, you know, and because I think what happens with a lot of these women is they come out the prison doors and they might have given an address, but in reality they've nowhere to go. Mm-hmm. Then they're lost into the system until they're back before the courts.
Ivana, you were a rapporteur, as I say, on this for the Oireachtas Justice Subcommittee. Now, is it your contention that only for violent and other major crimes should women go to jail?
Well, the report we did for the Justice Committee, which was published in March, is a report more generally on penal reform. And we were looking at prison generally and not specifically for women prisoners. We visited Finland. We looked at, on the advice of experts who gave evidence before our hearings here in Dublin, were told that the Finnish experience was worth us looking at. And we went to look at that because what we were doing was really following up on the recommendations of the Thornton Hall review report, which itself had addressed overcrowding is a really major issue within the prison system generally in Ireland. And we were looking at how you tackle issues of overcrowding and how you bring in a penal reform strategy generally. And Finland is interesting because, you know, it had in fact very high rates of imprisonment after the Second World War and until the early 1960s, when a political decision was taken to move away from the old Russian model, which they had followed in their justice system, and to move closer to the Nordic welfare model, reduce their reliance on prison and start increasing the use of community-based sanctions instead. And really we found the experiences there quite inspirational, you know, because they adopted effectively a decarceration strategy where you look to reduce the numbers of people in prison, as you said, Audrey, for those non-violent offenders currently being sentenced to very short stays in prison.
That was the target. How did they do that? Finland.
Well, they commuted prison sentences, short prison sentences, and one of our recommendations is that prison sentences of less than 6 months for non-violent offences should be commuted, and that, in other words, be replaced with community service orders. So the sort of very positive work that Anya is talking about could be done outside of the prison setting, in hostels, in community centres, rather than in prisons. And of course, one thing we should say about the Doha Centre, however, you know, that it was an enlightened place in 1999 when it opened, but it's a closed prison. You know, there is no open prison for women. While for male prisoners there are different models of prison in Ireland, you know, people can be sent to open prisons where they're out on day release and so on. on and much more and much much less tight security. But for women, there is only the closed prison, either in Limerick for a very small number or the DOCA centre. So, you know, one of the things that we were recommending was prison conditions should be changed, but also that we should be looking at commuting prison sentences, higher levels of remission, but overall that there should be a strategy in place to reduce prison numbers, to ensure that prison is genuinely a sanction of last resort, and that particularly for non-violent offenders that we operate a diversion strategy. And I must say one thing that really impressed us in Finland, in a very practical way, how they operate this, is that the prison governor of the very impressive open prison we visited is also the head of the local probation service. So there is a seamless, there was a merger of the two services, which has meant that you can deliver rehabilitative strategies much more effectively between both prison and the community. And there isn't the same sort of division of services. Now, I think things have improved in Ireland, I must say. I think genuinely, the prison service and the probation service work well together.
Well, Vivian Geeran, who's the director of the probation service, tweeted a little earlier when we tweeted ourselves what we were discussing tonight. And he has tweeted that 8 times as many women are on probation supervision in the community as are in prison in Ireland every day. Liam?
I think from what Ivana's saying about the Nordic approach generally, which is very positive, is lower rates of imprisonment. But of course, one important thing to bear in mind about Finland and other Nordic countries is they have good social supports. And that's been a critical element of how they've been able to do this. I mean, there's better cooperation between prisons and probation. That's absolutely true. But if we're really serious about addressing this issue, that we have a group of women with incredibly complex and high needs, and it's a small group of women, we're essentially talking about 50 or 60 women in the country, mainly in Dublin, but also in other urban centres, that are in homeless services, prison services, mental health services in a cycle for years and years, end up spending years in prison, but never on any serious charges.
And are they more complex and difficult than men's needs?
They are, because I think, the proportion that have are homeless, that have had psychiatric detention previously, that have had histories of domestic violence and sexual violence, that are chronic addicts, is a higher proportion than it is for men in terms of those that are committed to prison.
High levels of self-harm, also much higher rates of dependency, of course, children dependent on them. And for the, one can't overlook the huge impact of incarceration of their mothers on the children. I mean, Liam and the IPRT have done a lot of work on
that. Absolutely. That's a huge added dimension, because they're not only carers of children, but they're often carers of older family members too. But the real danger would be that we would try to solve this in a criminal justice context, because if at the same time we are cutting funding for homeless services in Dublin, we're cutting services for drug counselling services and drug residential treatment services in Dublin, then we're wasting our time. And what's actually happened as a success in comparable jurisdictions to us, like in Scotland and England in recent years, is they've decided to invest money in community care of drugs, homelessness, and they built an economic case, because they said obviously you have to justify funding in a very difficult time. The case was made by an economic think tank in London that £1 invested in community mental health and homeless services would have a £14 social dividend in saving criminal justice costs in the future. But this means we have to be imaginative and be willing to spend extra money on mental health services to save money in another government department, and we're not very good at that.
We did actually raise this evening in the Shannon, as it happens. We had a debate on mental health services, and Minister Kathleen Lynch was responding to it, and given that she had launched the report on women in prison this morning for the Penal Reform Trust, we raised with her this very issue, that in psychiatric and mental health services we do have a strong commitment now from a move away from incarceration and institutional care to care in the community. And it's exactly that model that we need to adopt
What Vivian Geeran, the director of the probation service, says, that 8 times as many women on probation in the community as are in prison. Is that an indicator that it is moving in the right direction?
Well, I think there's a debate happening within the probation service about how best to work with women offenders. And I think certainly, just going back to the point about, why are women offenders different to male offenders? At the end of the day, everybody deserves to get the best service to meet their needs. But I suppose women, it takes an awful lot more for women to actually come into prison. And so when they do come to the point of being sentenced, they have a huge range of needs. And as I said earlier, they face huge levels of stigma and isolation. And I suppose the probation service works very well with women in the community. And, within the homeless team, you know, we've tried to, one probation officer tries to work solely with women. So there can be, and there is very good work being done. What I just go back to Ivana's point about the probation service and the Irish Prison Service being joined up together. Our members would not support that because the Irish Probation Service is very much based on a social work model, where we our officers are social work qualified. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very important when it comes to working with offenders such as women offenders, that we understand the complex needs. So while the probation officers branch of Impact would welcome a greater working relationship, and certainly there appears to be a greater working relationship between our service and the Irish Prison Service, I think it's very important that we hold on to our own social work ethics and values.
Do you accept that, Ivana?
Well, I think that, you know, there has been a change within prison officer mm-hmm. service too. I think what was seen at one time as very much a discipline force, very much a in that vein. Mm-hmm. I think there is an increased emphasis on rehabilitation being offered within prisons. Mm-hmm. You know, I was a very enthusiastic supporter of the Connect programme, yes. which was run within prisons. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's still a real shame mm-hmm. that funding was stopped for that some years ago. It was a programme that was rolled out first in Mountjoy, but then in mm-hmm. Doka. I saw it in operation mm-hmm. in the Doka Centre as well as Mountjoy and other prisons. And it was a programme that was run by prison officers, offering with support from probation yeah. and other services, but offering one-to-one supports, mm. things like anger management and parenting courses. It was very much a very targeted rehabilitation programme that had some very impressive results. And
my,
I think that did give
Ivana
prison officers
it's,
a different
it's, while it's named differently now, that still is there in existence. And I think certainly Michael Donlan, the director of the Irish Prison Service, who moved from the probation service yeah. over to the Irish Prison Service has very much focused in on issues like that. So I think yes, that the Irish Prison Service are developing, you know, as Ivana says, but I still would. Our members would still hope to hold on to our own agency. Yeah.
Dervil, it's often been said that we're a very good country at locking people up. Mm. I mean, down the decades and down the generations. Is the political will there, in your view, to engage in a new sort of thinking? Owen Carroll has tweeted that the Irish Prison Service say they're committed to a strategy document for responding to women in prison. It was due back in May, but we're still waiting on it.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, listening to the debate tonight, this all ultimately comes down to political choices. And I think that it has suited politicians past and present and others to define this merely just as a criminal justice problem, because then that means you don't have to accept responsibility for the wider issues. And I think if you do spend any time, as I unfortunately do on occasion, down in the district court and just see the chaos of humanity in there, you know, most people in there shouldn't be coming before courts at all. They should be getting, you know, proper mental health supports. It's quite tragic and sad, and as I said earlier, people have very, very little sympathy for it. But I think that, you know, it would be really, really interesting. You know, we routinely kind of pop out what it costs, but I know the number's falling, but at one point it was costing 100 grand a year, you know, to house a prisoner. And a real kind of cost benefit analysis, a social dividend, would be really, really meaningful, I think, you know, in an Irish context. Certainly the criminal justice policy aspect of it does have to be looked at. You know, again, like, you know, what choices do judges have? The lack of those community sanctions. But if you are going to have a system with community sanctions, that has to be supported. It has to be resourced. And if it's not fully resourced, well, then you're not, as you said, Liam, you know, you're not going to tackle the problem. So ultimately, the responsibility does fall back to politics.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the kind of choices that can be made, and I suppose this is the purpose of our conference today, is we had speakers over from England, Scotland and Northern Ireland, which have all been through this process in the last 10 years. In England, the crisis was precipitated by a high level of suicide in women's prisons, mm-hmm. which thankfully we haven't had here mm-hmm. since the Doka Centre was built. But the ultimate conclusion was that it has to be a shared political responsibility mm-hmm. outside of the Justice Department. And the move, particularly in England and also in Scotland, is that local authorities have a legal duty, particularly around accommodation of people on release. Now, local authorities here don't want to have that responsibility. Mm-hmm. But, you know, people leaving prison are citizens. They are people going back into communities. And it was a hard-fought battle in England to get to that stage. Mm-hmm. But we have a situation where local authorities here are not living up to their obligations to provide accommodation to people leaving prison, even though these are clearly perhaps the most high-risk group in the community. And the social cost of not meeting that need is much, much higher. So local authorities need to have a duty. Mental health services, and this is the HSE and the Department of Health, need to step up and provide proper services. And the Homeless Agency in Dublin City Council and other local authorities need to too. Now, on a positive side about that, the Prison Service and Probation Service at the moment, as we understand it, are in talks with Dublin City Council and the Homeless Agency and the HSE about developing a joint service. And that is exactly where we need to go. But it needs a number of government ministers to step up.
It requires leadership.
It does.
It requires real leadership, yeah. You know, just to
at a cabinet level. Yeah. You know, it will.
And from a number of ministers. I mean, I think the point you're making about the interagency approach, and Minister Lynch was making it tonight in the context of psychiatric care. And I do think there's a cause for optimism when we look at the enormous change that's occurred in psychiatric services and mental health services in Ireland. I mean, we incarcerated far more people in psychiatric institutions through most of the 20th century in this country than we ever did in our prisons. A colleague of mine in Trinity, Damien Brennan, has just written a really excellent study of insanity. He calls it insanity in Ireland and the treatment of people with mental health problems. And we've moved from an evidence perspective, we've moved to care in the community. And I think there will come a point where, and it's coming with this sort of debate, where we see the same sort of change and the same fundamental shift for prison population.
I think that was the vision of Vision for Change.
That's right.
To go from psychiatric detention into care in the community. But in some circumstances, it has gone from incarceration in psychiatric hospitals to incarceration in prison. And the community services have not been provided, particularly for the very high risk groups that are difficult to deliver services to. You know, the women that are in the DOCA centre are women that maybe in a previous time would have been in residential psychiatric services. Yeah. And they're, for whatever reasons, they are not accessing those services in the community. And that is an indictment of how we deliver services. Now, they're undoubtedly a hard group to reach. Nobody's saying it's easy. But I think, you know, one of the models that is being developed, as I say, in the UK, is if you have a community centre that the gate is through the criminal justice system, but in the same place they're accessing homeless and mental health services together, it seems to work better.
And again, we do have models with the diversion programme Harry Kennedy's been running with the drugs courts.
Absolutely.
But it's just still quite small scale. But you're quite right, of course, and that point is well made, that we've moved from incarceration psychiatric institutions, in some cases very literally with Castlereagh, you know, a conversion of psychiatric institution into a penal institution. But there's still the numbers are smaller, and I think we've identified the problem. And I do think, you know, we are moving towards the model. I mean, there's some again positive news in the terms of the lower numbers of people, of men being committed to prison.
Absolutely.
And it's great that Judge Riley, I think, and that the Penal Reform Trust have drawn attention to the other trend, the upward trend, the numbers of women being committed for whatever reason. And I think, you know, but now is the time to try and put a stop to that, to ensure that we're not committing women who clearly shouldn't be in the prison. I mean, the fine default legislation, that is one very obvious way of changing that, is implementing that legislation so that people are no longer being sent in for fine default.
And it was very encouraging today that they've actually solved that problem in both Scotland and Northern Ireland in the last 2 years. They've moved from a position of having very high rate of fine defaulters in prison like we do to having nil, you know, so it can be done.
That's what we need to do. I mean, I would see that almost as the very first.
And what did they do in those jurisdictions?
They took the legislative approach, which meant that fine default would lead to community service, supervised community sanctions as opposed to imprisonment. Now, that's part of what's being proposed here at the moment.
And the legislation's there, but just not fully operational.
Yeah, and I think there is a broader public confidence issue as well, because if you look actually at the reason why women go into prison, kind of the category of sentences, even though a lot of them might be considered low-level offences, petty crime or theft, public order, they're still criminal offences that the public are very, very aggrieved about. You know, and I think that is the reason why diversionary programmes and that kind of critical interventions are important, because I think that's one of the reasons why there is very little public sympathy at times towards these women, and especially if you have, and I have been myself, you know, got my bag stolen once by a woman in a bus station, you know, you're upset about it at the time, it's not even worth reporting, but you know, just to look into someone's eyes and to see how chaotic their lives are, but it's one of the reasons why I think we don't have sympathy, because we look down, you know, on these people, but there's a broader public confidence issue that has to be addressed.
And I suppose it's about having the debate and saying to the public that this is about reducing the risk of reoffending. This is about ensuring that there are safer communities, because if you target these women who are, you know, recidivists who are in and out of custody, if you look at, you know, their needs, and the first need obviously is homelessness, and then you can look at everything else. But if you do that, well, then you reduce their risk of further reoffending, and that is value for money, and that means safer society.
Because on your point, Dermot, Liam from Cork has just texted, when will you do a programme on the victims of crime? What model do your panel have for them?
Could I just say one thing we haven't addressed, which is very much a victim-centred and victim-focused anarchist approach, and an alternative approach is, of course, restorative justice, mm-hmm. where again we have a number of mm-hmm. you know, really excellent, positive, but very small scale pilot mm-hmm. projects in operation mm-hmm. around the country, where they offer to the, you know, a much more victim centred approach, where the offender is, instead of just being sent to prison, where they're, you know, going to yeah. come out without and mm-hmm. reoffend, yeah. where they're in fact faced with the victim, forced to make reparation to mm-hmm. the victim in some way, and where the victim is involved in the sanctioning. And I think that model, which yeah. we've seen used very effectively elsewhere, could
I think that has to be elective, though not every time.
I think with non-violent offenders, you can challenge criminal attitudes, and you can challenge criminal beliefs, and the therapeutic relationship, either by a probation officer or a counsellor or a psychologist or a key worker in a probation funded hostel, that challenging those beliefs, empowering women to make pro-social decisions, empowering them to return to education, return to training, you know, that will mean they are less likely to reoffend. Somebody is less likely to have their bag snatched or, you know, be a victim of crime. And of course, we must look
for. I think it's a critical point in response to what the listener has said there. Mm. I mean, I think Dervil said already we need to have a dispassionate analysis of this issue. We've talked a lot about the social justice mm-hmm. dimension mm-hmm. to it. And we'd unashamedly say that we're looking to respect the rights of the women involved. But there is a crime aspect here. Mm-hmm. If you look at the population in Dublin, male and female, and also reflected in other urban centres as well, that are addicted to heroin in particular, and also have chronic alcohol problems, and the amount of small-level crime that they are responsible for. As a small, tiny population in a city, they're responsible for a hugely disproportionate amount of offending of that nature. And what we do at the moment is clearly ineffective in breaking the cycle of their offending, which precipitates a huge amount of crime. Mm-hmm. And more effective responses, which would, you know, address their problems, would clearly be of huge social benefit.
But do you think community service orders is that solution to break that cycle?
It's part of it. No, I think, you know, if the underlying cause of the offending is homelessness and addiction, then that is primarily where the solution will lie. You know,
yeah, so a community service order alone won't tackle that. But I think it's true to say, I mean, every neighbourhood watch and every local community guard will tell you, if you know, you have just a handful of people responsible in any one area for a large amount of burglaries, of thefts and so on. And so targeting interventions on those individuals is going to save mm-hmm. a lot of people from being victims of crime.
Which is the philosophy behind the community or the problem solving courts, which Judge mm-hmm. Riley is talking about as well.
Yes,
you know?
He's very keen on the community courts, which, you know, again, is something we haven't really explored in any great depth. We've got the drugs court, but it's never really been, and that has had some positive mm-hmm. Results, but it hasn't really been rolled out. We've been very good, I suppose, over the years in, you know, adopting or trying to adopt pilot programs and running them in a small level and never expanding them mm-hmm. or extending them to a national
and
level.
Things,
and we need to explore that more.
Yeah, and in terms of like the media debate, like, I mean, the crimes that affect people the most are reported the least. You know, we do have this inverse reporting kind of pyramid
mobile
with it.
Mobile phone theft.
You know, well, mobile phone theft is now so pervasive that it is being discussed, but you know, and that's what I think our responsibility in the media. You know, I'm reluctant sometimes to talk about prisons because I get dismissed as a lefty liberal, you know, because people actually don't want to get into the difficult debate and look at the underlying causes and the complexities and accept that maybe we all have responsibility. You know, look, I mean, if somebody, you know, steals something from you, you don't actually know the chaos behind their lives. You know, they mightn't feel buying into the social contract if they're suffering, you know, so much. And I just think that's maybe something we need to look at. Like, I mean, you really should go into the district court, you know, someday and just spend an hour or two listening and watching and observing. It's actually, you just get to see a different side of Irish life that perhaps we're impervious to or just, you know, have no knowledge or appreciation of it. But I think that as well, that's one of the problems, that in terms of the public debate about this crime is largely hidden and unseen in terms of what you might see in the national media.
That's right. But I mean, at the same time, none of us are saying that the chaotic lives you see in the district court every day, as Dervil has said, those aren't excuses, of course, for criminal behaviour. None of us are saying that. But I think, again, it is about taking a pragmatic look at how we best go about crime prevention and making communities safer. And that is about interventions.
But Ivana, what has happened to your report? I mean, you say you reported earlier this year the subcommittee of the Oireachtas Justice Committee after your travels to Helsinki and so on. Is your report just languishing?
No, we had a good deal of publicity around the launch of the report. We have invited that we'll be having debates on it in the Dáil and Seanad on the recommendations in the report, and of course we've sent it to the minister, who has said told us it will feed into the white paper that is currently, and Liam in fact is on the working group on penal reform, which is due to report, I think the minister said today, early in 2014, and that we'll be reporting that is taking a broader look at the criminal justice system. We were looking quite specifically at strategies to reduce overcrowding and reduce reliance on imprisonment, and specifically sort of backdoor, in other words, end of sentence strategies around remission and temporary release. So I'm hopeful that I think this working group is really the first time for a long time, probably since the Whitaker Committee, that we've had such a comprehensive review of the criminal justice system. And I'd be hopeful that we'll see some radical reforms.
Well, do you expect much radical reform, Liam?
I think going back again to the Finnish example that Ivana referred to, what happened in Finland has been studied quite a lot, because a lot of countries had huge increases in their prison population during that period, and some countries had a decarceration. And I think some of the experts that have spoken about it said you need to have lined up a number of things. You need to have leadership, certainly. You need to have a political consensus across parties. And I think at the moment we're not too far away from that compared to what it's in the 90s.
That's quite right. We had cross-party support.
The Oireachtas Committee
on
reports,
the Justice Committee. This isn't any one party doesn't own this. This is a cross-party report.
And public opinion is important. I think, as Derval said, you need to have confidence. Now, I think the public here aren't actually given enough credit sometimes. I think in the past, politicians have hidden behind the public, saying we can't take progressive approaches to crime because the public are more punitive. I think the public understand quite well that what we're doing at the moment doesn't work, and there are more effective ways which will help.
But also politicians think that, for some politicians from time to time, think that the more punitive they come out and sounding, especially on issues surrounding bail, sentencing, there was a huge brouhaha by some when your own report, Ivana, talked about, you know, actually increasing remission, you know, and there's, you know, a big hue and cry. But I actually think you're right. I think the public, when they are fully informed, they're better. But sometimes actually it's the politicians who can exploit that punitive
I was pleasantly surprised that there wasn't more outcry about that. I mean,
just in some quarters.
It was very small. And I mean, I must say, you know, our committee chair, Deputy David Stanton, you know, the full, you know, deputies and senators from all parties and from none endorsed the recommendations in the report. And, you know, the more we looked into this, the more evidence we heard from experts and from people working on the front line, the more the suggestions we were making made sense to us, that you should look at increasing remission, giving people incentives to have temporary release. We have a somewhat chaotic and unstructured temporary release system currently. Now, it is improving, but there's been a tendency, and again because of chronic overcrowding, that the prison governor will just let somebody out without any advance planning or preparation.
But even, Ivana, debates around, you know, which we're saying chronic developments in the UK, even the public debate around criminal legal aid, you know, again, it's very, very anti-prisoner, very, very anti the person who is coming before the courts. And I think that kind of contribution to the public debate can be really unhelpful when you're actually trying to improve the position of prisoners.
I do think things are better here, and I think we're actually in a reasonably positive moment. But I would be positive, because ultimately this is about what works or doesn't work. You know, if you have a reasoned, calm debate about issues to do with crime, which is an emotive issue, and any crime is obviously a hugely traumatic event for the victim of the crime. But if you can have a dispassionate, evidence-led debate around it, you'll end up getting better and more effective policies and solutions. And I think there are some positive signs that, you know, there's a real will at the moment by policymakers and the prison service, probation service and the key agencies to work more together and come up with solutions. And, you know, in the 1990s, when we had a lot of money, it was quite the opposite. Yeah. There was an awful lot of emotion
and
hostility
about
it. That's when
the rhetoric I was talking about was actually most obvious, you know, from politicians. And I must say, you know, Minister Shatter spoke at the Penal Reform Trust annual meeting and has spoken very positively about measures to tackle overcrowding and about imprisonment as a last sanction of last resort. And I think there is more of a political will now, and it may be to do with economic.
Again, I think if you make what Liam was saying earlier, if you make the economic case, and that actually may be a way to win over public confidence, if we make a good economic case for keeping people out.
And the Troika talked about diverting people out of prison too, so I mean it is coming from that side of things as well.
But in Britain, in fact, that was an important part of the debate when they were looking at less reliance on prison. A lot of the debate was around economic.
Yeah. And I suppose just, you know, to make society safer as well. This is about helping the offender, but it's also about ensuring that we have safer communities.
But Liam, we don't do radical in this country, do we? in terms of policies and new ideas?
Yeah, look, it's like everything else. You know, if you were starting again, you wouldn't start from here. You know, the best can be the enemy of the good at times as well. And I think what we're trying to focus on is practical ways to move forward.
But do you expect the main recommendation in Ivana's and the committee's report about commuting short sentences? Sentences of less than 6 months.
I think that the main thrust of it, I think there's strong support for it, yeah. And I mean, Ivana, that was an Oireachtas cross-party report, which I think is hugely significant. It indicates that no party wants to try to play the crime card in a really radical way at the moment. The group that I'm on is bringing together the Prison Service, Probation Service and stakeholders like us to advise the minister. And I think the recommendations will be broadly probably in the same direction. And it seems to be the way things are moving. We don't want radical solutions and we don't want to reinvent the wheel. You know, other countries follow these face these problems too. But I think we can improve what we have at the moment gradually over time. If we have a couple of core principles involved, and one of them is, if you can solve a problem without using prison, do it that way. You know, avoid using prison if at all possible. And I think that is, I think the judges are increasingly accepting that that's the way we need to go. I think the Prison Service and Probation Service are clearly articulating that, and communities would be safer. So we're not talking about a radical change, we're talking about a change in emphasis. And we have to remember our prison population doubled here in the last 15 years.
So we've actually had the radical change. I should have said rational recommendations rather than radical from the working group. I mean, Liam's right. These aren't radical.
The radical thing is when we went the other direction during the 1990s.
I mean, a radical increase in the numbers of prison places. That's what we saw in the 90s, and a radical increase in the use of those places. Yeah, and I think we need to look rationally
now. Your definition of radical, I suppose, in which direction you're looking at. Look, thank you all very much indeed for coming in and discussing and debating this tonight. Ivana Bacik, Liam Herrick, Áine Morris and Dervil MacDonald. We're back at the usual time, 10 o'clock tomorrow night. Until then, from all the team, good night.
The Late Debate with Audrey Carville was produced by Donal O'Herlihy. The broadcast coordinator was Maeve Mooney. The researcher was Richie Byrne. And Kieran Dunn was on sound.